The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
So, Mike, we're talking about graphite today. That's a subject that you know plenty about. You're the top man at Blencoe, which has a graphite project in Uganda. But first of all, let's talk about graphite as a product, as an element. What is it? Tell us a little bit first about what graphite is. Carbon, I suppose, is the place to start.
Yeah, I guess graphite is sort of perhaps understood best for things like tennis rackets and pencils and, you know, some of the more traditional things that people understand it by. But it actually has, at last count, over 150 different applications which it's used for. It is carbon and in a form. And it's really got two major characteristics, I guess, that define what graphite is used for. Firstly, it's got high conductivity, and secondly, it's got a very high heat resistance. So when you think about the various different applications for graphite, they tend to be very linked into either one or both of those. So when we have graphite, for example, in our cell phones, it's to do with both the high conductivity and the element of heat resistance as well. When it's used to line steel foundries or for gaskets or for flame retardants, it's all to do with that heat resistance because it burns at an extremely high temperature. So it's an abundantly found mineral around the world. It's plenty of it. There are certain issues around it in terms of its characteristics. For example, its chemical characteristics are different in every single project. And that's really to do with how it can be purified into concentrates and beyond, and what sort of energy density it may have and how it's utilized thereafter. So there's a complexity to it, but there's also a simplicity to it. But I guess it's something that the world really needs to understand a lot more of, because at this stage, it's a vital part of the lithium-ion battery. It makes up the anode. And that's obviously something that's very important for most of us in our life going forward, because the EVs that we're obviously transitioning to, all the solar and other renewable power that we're transitioning to, all require energy storage. And at the moment, that is a lithium-ion battery which contains graphite as a non-replaceable input. So, yeah, that's probably about as much as I can say for now without going on for 2 hours. But as you can tell, there's an awful lot that can be said about it. I'm trying to sort of keep it at a level where it remains user-friendly.
Yeah, well, I mean, let's unpack a few of those things sort of each in turn. I guess the hottest topic in graphite really at the moment is the conductivity, isn't it? Heat resistant as well, but conductivity is the thing that kind of people really sit up and take notice about, because as you mentioned, it's lithium ion batteries and so on and so forth. So when you say conductivity, what do you really mean? You mean electricity can go across it in an efficient way?
Now, when you're passing charge in a lithium ion battery, you've essentially got ions that are moving back and forward, and it's that movement of them which is creating the energy that drives the battery. And it's the conductivity is dealt with between the lithium on the one side on the cathode and the graphite on the other side in the anode. So that conductivity, and it's really got what they call interlacing. So you've really got the lithium ions which are filtering in between the layers of graphite, and then moving back to the other side. And it's that constant back and forth which is creating the charge which drives everything from, in terms of the battery strength. And obviously the quality of that is what makes it a good battery or makes it a bad battery in terms of, length of service, et cetera. So it can get fairly complex when you get into it, because the way that graphite is purified to go into those batteries is not just your simple lead pencil that people understand better, but it is spheronized, purified graphite that goes in there, tiny, millions and millions of tiny little balls, because that's the best way to store that energy and to get the most out of it. But it is a vital non-replaceable input for lithium-ion batteries. And as you said, that's really which is getting all the attention going forward.
I mean, we should perhaps say that although they're called lithium-ion batteries, there's a significant component of graphite. I mean, it's not just a tiny speck, in relation to the lithium. There's actually quite a lot of graphite in a lithium-ion battery relative to the overall size of
Absolutely.
the battery. So, I
Yep.
mean, tell us a little bit about that. What sort of proportions
Well, I mean,
specifically?
Elon Musk talks about the lithium-ion battery. He calls it a nickel graphite battery because those are the two things that actually make up most of the content. Typically, in a typical EV battery, you're getting about 50 kilograms of graphite. So that makes up by far the biggest component by weight. Not necessarily by value, because obviously the lithium carbonate is worth a whole lot more than the graphite, but certainly in terms of weight, it makes up a significant part of it. The other components of that battery, lithium carbonate, as I say, you've got nickel, you've got manganese, and graphite. So, yeah, then there are various different iterations of batteries which are obviously getting tested. That's the battery of choice at the moment. There's a lot of different varieties and different models and different types of batteries being put onto the market now, and obviously there are different reasons why each of them makes sense. But that's a very sort of complicated route to go down because there's probably at last count over 20 different types of alternatives to lithium-ion batteries that are under testing.
I mean, do you think sentiment towards graphite, the graphite mining sector, might be slightly better if actually these lithium-ion batteries were called nickel graphite batteries in common parlance?
It's a good point. I think it would definitely pe make people more aware of it, and I wouldn't have to keep answering questions while I'm trying to set up a mine to do tennis rackets and lead pencils. And people may have a better understanding of what the future demand, why there's such a significant forecast demand for graphite going forward. But at the end of the day, there's a whole educational process that is becoming more, and I think the market is becoming more and more aware of it. It's just a question of trying to unpack it all and get people to really understand that if we're going to have an energy transition, graphite's a significant part of
Yeah, I
that.
mean, I suppose the lithium price hasn't been doing that well lately either, even though the battery is called the lithium ion battery. I mean, you mentioned a moment ago, Mike, that graphite is actually quite abundant. It was a sort of passing phrase that you used. So, how much graphite is there in the world? How easy is it to find? And then, I mean, you talked in your follow-up remark about the sort of varying complexities of the processing. But I mean, is there a lot of graphite just sort of spread around the world in its initial form?
There is. And I mean, and most of the projects have significant graphite in them as well. For example, our project, Blenko's Aurum Cross project, has an estimated 2 to 3 billion tons of graphite, which is a heck of a lot of graphite in one project. But there are, a number of significant projects around the world that do hold a lot of graphite. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean it's all available or it's all usable in the form that it's in, or in the jurisdiction it's in, or with the particular characteristics that it's got. But you find graphite, a lot of graphite in East Africa, you find it in Australia, there's graphite in Canada, in Brazil, pretty much in every continent, because you actually find it in even in Europe. There's significant graphite projects there as well. So it is plenty of it around. As I say, the complexity is trying to move it from something that's in the ground to something that you can actually mine in a successful and commercially viable manner.
Yeah, I mean, it comes in quite a complicated context when you start reading about graphite projects. For example, let's just dive into the one that always perplexes me, the flake size. Now, I think that relates to conductivity to some extent in what we were talking about a moment ago. But tell us a little bit about what the flake size means and whether you can get varying flake size within a project and how that all fits together.
I mean, I'm going to try and keep it as simple language as possible, but it really, you have different micron sizes for graphite flakes, and they are basically along a spectre or spectrum, I beg your pardon, that essentially guides the end user towards understanding whether it's a large flake or a small flake. And obviously, the larger flakes have bigger sizes, micron sizes, and the smaller flakes, smaller ones. And you're right, the two of them have very different uses. In that very traditional market, which is typically the heat-resistant market, then the larger flakes are used for that. They are, by the way, a lot less abundant. They're a lot harder to get as a concentrate. And there's certainly less of them in China, which is obviously the biggest producer of graphite in the world today. So they sell for a lot more as a concentrate. But the large flakes are different from the small flakes, and the small flakes are the ones that get essentially put into the purified, as a purified product, get put into the electric vehicle, into the lithium-ion batteries for the electric vehicles. So the flake size is something that occurs naturally. So when you go and literally dig it out and do your exploration, do your assays, and have a look at it through a microscope, you will see different flake sizes within your graphite in situ in the ground. And that's one part of it. But actually, what matters is once you've taken it through your float process and you've produced a concentrate, you break up some of the large flakes in order to get your end product. So you end up with a mix of large and small flake as a concentrate once you've got to that 95%, which is what the market demands for the concentrates. And as I said, that's determining then where it goes as an end user product in terms of small flake or large flake.
Yeah, so I mean, you mentioned concentrate there. So let's take a step back in that process. So when you find, I mean, let's speak generally, I suppose, or feel free to get specific if you want. But if you find graphite, are you finding it in an ore, or in what form does it show up in the microscope that you referred to a moment ago?
Well, you can find it in lots of things. I mean, we've got graphite near the surface in saprolitic clay, so it sits within the clays. And further down, where it gets into the fresh rock, you have got it sitting within hard rocks. So you can find it in both, and it's really it's mined from both. It's just really a question then: do you have to drill and blast? Do you have to take it through that process in a different manner if it's coming from hard rock as opposed to a clay, for example? So for us, some of our operating costs remain very low because we've got a free dig because it's coming from that clay. But you have to treat it slightly differently in the processing. So you can get both.
Yeah, so if you've got some graphite in saprolite or in hard rock, does it occur as graphite or is it in compound with anything else?
No, it's typically as graphite. It is generally sitting within that as graphite on its own.
So you can basically concentrate, if you've got hard rock, let's say, you crush the rock and then concentrate a higher degree of graphite material. Into a concentrate, and then if that was the case, you would then sell it on to a processing operation, I suppose.
Yeah, what happens when you're processing it is you take it through a float circuit and you're really just further purifying it at each stage. So you might take it through some going to go through three or four different floats to get to the concentrate. Others have to go through six or seven. But at each stage, you're taking graphite and you're taking it from a 10%, then you take it to a 20%, and then a 40% and a 60%. And ultimately, as I said before, you've ultimately got to get it to that point where it gets to 94%, really, which is what the market's demanding as the minimum concentrate. And each project is different in terms of how many floats it's going to take to get you to that point. But that's where you've got to end up with. Otherwise, you just don't have a product the market wants to buy.
Yeah, so you've got this 94% concentrate, let's say. How does that appear? Do you sort of bag it up in sacks and ship
I'm
it
going to
out?
find you a little bit if I can find some on my desk. Oh, you probably can't see that particularly well, but I mean,
We can see it to some degree, yeah.
it's a fine powder.
Right.
It comes through wet once it comes through the float circuit, and then you put it through a dryer, and that dryer turns it into a fine powder. And that fine powder then gets, as I say, it's got different flake sizes. Some of it will be larger flakes, some of it will be smaller. But then you can actually just to get another degree of variability, you can micronize graphite, which basically takes specialist mills and grinds it down even further into much smaller particle sizes, which make it more valuable because it's used in niche markets and niche industries. So micronization is a slightly different avenue, but it does come through as a very fine powder at the end of that process.
Right, so a graphite miner would they, Mike, to sell a concentrate at that sort of grade onto a sort of final into a final production process that's conducted by somebody else to make 100% graphite?
Yeah, there's a number of different stages within the process of getting it to the battery. As you say, the miner typically takes it up to a concentrate and sells it as a concentrate. And we're talking about small flake concentrate here because the large flake product goes straight through into whatever it's going to go into. It can also, by the way, get purified too. But in terms of the battery product, the small flakes, the requirement for a battery is what's called spheronized purified graphite, which is SPG, which is 99.95% purified graphite. So what you're doing is you're actually taking it up through from 94, 95% to that 99.95%. And typically that's done through acid leaching, although one of the processes that we're looking to do because it's more environmentally friendly is to take it through a thermal process where you're literally taking it up to about 3,000 degrees centigrade and burning off everything else, and literally the graphite remains. But more traditionally, the acid leaching does the same thing, where you're taking away the impurities and ultimately leaving yourself with a highly purified SPG product. And that's skill set that's not done by the miners. It's very much a processing set of skills that's been, I guess, taken on board by the Chinese over the last 30 years. They've perfected it through years and years of experience. And look, the Western markets have been left behind. It was all very nice and easy and simple just to say to China, you go and do it and we'll buy it off you. Suddenly, as the geopolitical wheel starts to turn, everyone's realizing that there's obviously risk associated with them doing 95 to 98% of the world's purification of graphite. And by the way, it's very similar in other things as well, be it lithium, nickel, cobalt, whatever. So graphite is no different. The experts sitting in the middle purify it, if we can call it, or beneficiate it. And they make a lot of money. I'm sitting here crying into my soup as a potential miner. We don't make big money producing concentrates. The guys who buy it off us and take it up to a more purified product tend to make a lot more money. And then it takes another step beyond that, because actually what goes into the battery is it firstly, it's an uncoated SPG, uncoated spheronized purified graphite. It has to be rounded, which is what the spheronization means, because the more round it is, the more value it's got, the more energy content it will hold. And then ultimately, it has to be coated. And the coating keeps that energy content in for longer. So it effectively allows the battery to have a longer life. And so that in itself, the coating is another step and another stage which requires skills and expertise. And again, most of that is done in China. And then ultimately, once you've got a coated spheronized purified graphite, that's what's given into the anode, and obviously within that anode it goes into the lithium ion battery. So it's a series of steps, and we find ourselves in a situation now as a world where in order to avoid, I guess, more geopolitical risk, we need to try and find ways and means by which we can take those next steps and do it outside of China. Otherwise we're going to be beholden to them forever. And that's a big part, I guess, of the strategies in many Western countries today, is to try and take away not just the avoidance of critical minerals in terms of mining them, but much, much more so in terms of processing them into the end products.
Yeah, so just talking about the SPG though, so you've got SPG and you're coating it. So first of all, what does SPG look like? And also, what does it get coated in?
Well, it's around. I mean, I say it's round because it's called spheronized. But if you actually look at the if you look at it under the microscope, you will see that it's almost impossible to get a totally round graphite. But the more rounded it is, the better. And so, when they talk about the quality of your product moving from a concentrate up to an SPG, it's really about how rounded it can get. How many of them you can fit in into that very tiny small space, and ultimately it's all to do with those characteristics in terms of tap density, energy content, things like that. So it becomes highly specialized, and obviously there are experts around the world who understand that and will be able to explain to mere mortals like us exactly what your product looks like and whether it's of high quality or not so high quality. And ultimately, that's what the battery manufacturers or the anode manufacturers are looking for, because higher the quality that they're buying, the better it's going to perform in their end product. And so everybody's seeking best quality product. And so, again, when we started this conversation, I said there's lots and lots of graphite around, but taking it through to the end user is what counts. And being able to do the necessary metallurgical testing that ultimately proves that your product can actually get to that highly purified state and be one of the graphites that, or the SPGs that actually hold the best energy content, the best spheronization, all the things that matter. That's what all that millions of dollars of met test work that we get to do is all about, because it's really about, I guess, impressing the end user that they're going to get the best quality product around. And yeah, look, it's as I say, it's a technology and a complexity that labs around the world are very good at. Again, the Chinese are very good at it as well. But each and every project is different. So you've got what you've got. You can't just suddenly say, oh, we're going to wave a magic wand and turn our graphite into a better mix of large flakes versus small, or better energy content, or better this or better that. It is what it is. And with look, that's not entirely true, because very good processing capabilities can make your product better, but it's not going to turn A into Z. It's going to change it a bit, but not completely turn it into the best product forever. So yeah, it's a complexity that few understand. We're learning as we go. I mean, we've been involved in the space for 5, 6 years now, and I can honestly say that I'm learning something new every single day. And I don't think I'll ever know as much as some of the experts that I talk to on a regular basis. They sort of throw a few lines out and it goes straight over my head in 5 seconds. But the reality is, for the complete speciality stuff, we can get good advice from, experts who do know this stuff and do know what they're talking about. And then you can adjust your processing accordingly, or you can obviously understand what it is you're going to sell that product into, for what reasons, and you can generally get a good feel for what you've gotten and the value of it by doing it that way.
I
So
mean, let's
I
go
hope I haven't
back to
gone off
the
on a bit of a tangent.
let's go back to the flake size. You just mentioned that a second ago again, because I think I got that wrong, or I have got that wrong in the past. So just to reiterate what you were saying, the larger flakes are more likely to be used in flame retardants, and the smaller it goes, that's the more that type of material ends up in the batteries. So the smaller stuff is the more conductive graphite. Is
Yeah,
that
so the irony of this particular scenario is that the smaller flakes, which are the product that is required in the batteries, is actually the product that we get the least value for. So there's not a lot of motivation at the moment for graphite miners to go out and produce small flake concentrate, because most of them are barely making any profit on it at all. So a typical project, our Aurum Cross project is no different, would be about 50-50 in terms of the mix of large flake to small flake once you get it up to the 95, 96% concentrate. And so that large flake product, we can sell directly as a concentrate, and off it goes into end products, some of which they will purify further to take it through into, can be anything, lining steel foundries, Gaskets, flame retardants, expandables, anything, foils, those foils that you use, all of these things that have got heat resistance properties, that large flake product is typically used for. And you can actually had some, no, I think I've got pictures somewhere. I don't have them at hand to show you, but there's many, many different things that it's used for. And then the small flake product is what I'm talking about that gets taken up to the SPG and ultimately into the anode for the batteries. And yeah, look, the big challenge for everybody in terms of trying to make commercial sense and rationale of the graphite space is how do people get value for that approximately 50% of their end product that's sold into the largest growing market, because obviously the battery market, and particularly through for the EVs and for renewable storage, that's the largest forecast demand growth in all graphite, yet it doesn't pay, particularly if you're selling into the Asian markets. The Western markets are a little bit better. They pay a bit more, but unfortunately, at this stage, they're quite small. So if you're going to go into and mine a commercial scale of production, you are going to have to consider selling certainly some portion of that, probably a large portion of that, as small flake product into Asian markets and getting lower prices. And this is where it starts to get into the guts of it in terms of why there's going to be shortages of graphite going forward, because there's plenty of it in the world, as we said earlier. But if you take it up to a concentrate and you're selling it as a small flake concentrate and you're not getting paid a lot of money for that, then you can't justify the lack of profitability doesn't justify the investment decision or the capital required to start up the mine. So unless you're in a low capital startup position or a low cost operating cost scenario, it just becomes very, very challenging to make it economically and commercially viable. And herein lies the big question going forward, because with all the graphite around, only a very small percentage of that can be really considered as economically viable along the lines of where prices sit in today's markets.
So we talk about markets there, Mike. Let's spend a minute or so on that. What are the markets? I mean, do we have spot markets? Are there different markets? I mean, are they sort of physically located anywhere, or is it all offtake? Are there spot prices for large flake and offtake for small? I mean, how does it all sort of fit together in the graphite
Yeah,
world?
it's a complex process, these markets, and again, we're learning a lot as we go. I wish I was like in a base metals scenario where you've got a London metal market, you produce your copper, and you say, right, there we go. It's obviously to a certain percentage, and you sell it into that market, and you receive a value for it. It makes life a lot easier. Ditto with things like zinc and lead and other base metals. But with graphite, because the characteristics of each project is completely different, the end user needs to understand what it is they're buying. And so you have to go through what's called the pre-qualification process, by which you not only go through significant metallurgical testing in labs to prove what you've got. And that's not just as a concentrate, by the way, it's also taking it up to the 99.95. But once you've proved it in the labs on a lab scale, then you have to prove that it still maintains those same excellent qualities on a bulk scale. So that is really done by either building a pilot facility at site, which is obviously more expensive, or digging it out as a raw material and sending it off to somewhere like China, where they've got facilities that will beneficiate your product and showcase what it does look like as a bulk. And once you've proven what you can deliver as an end product in bulk, then you take those couple of tons typically, and you'll send them off to the various different OEMs that are the end users, and they are typically big Asian conglomerates that have got battery plants or anode plants. They're all slightly different, so some of them can be right across the board. Others are very specific in terms of what they do. But you send off the end product to them. They will take your product. They'll run it through their facility. They will see that they're going to get the end product that they want using your graphite. And they'll either decide to buy it as a product to blend with others, which will get you less money. Or if it's of high quality, they'll decide to take it on its own. And then you end up with an offtake contract with that particular party, and so on. And then you go to the next one and the next one. And I'm only talking about the small flake that goes into batteries, because you've also going through the same process with parties that are going to micronize it and use it for other product end products, and then parties that are going to take it for the large flake as well. So you've got quite a complicated sales and marketing process by which you're dealing with many, many different offtakers at any stage. And the ultimate goal, I guess, will be to narrow it down to a handful and ultimately be selling most, if not all, of your product through to those end users and build up long-term relationships with them, because I guess those relationships are important. And for them, it's starting to become increasingly important on the flip side, because they are, I'm talking about the OEMs, are noticing that there are not many graphite projects starting. The demand for graphite is forecast to rise, or certainly for natural flake graphite is forecast to rise by 1 million tons per annum by 2030, which requires an awful lot of new mines to come on board. And there are not that many who are making it through this pipeline. So they are also very keen as OEMs, as end users, to solidify their supply chain. And so you've got quite a lot of sort of tension happening at both sides, from both the supplier and the user. And yeah, I mean, it's a complicated process, but once you're out there and once you're showcasing what you've got, then if you've got something of value, typically people will start giving you a call and saying, "Can we have a look?" And then really it's just a question of getting samples to them, having some patience while they go through their procedures, because they don't move very quickly. And then ultimately getting expressions of interest, MOUs, offtake agreements. That's kind of how it works anyway, without getting too complex.
And how does the price get set?
Yeah, sorry, I was going to say I didn't mention pricing. So pricing changes and varies according to each and every different product within that mix. You can be sitting with a plus 32 super jumbo flake that sells on its own anyway for a couple of $1,000 per ton. And then you wind that back to smaller varieties of large and medium-sized flakes at the sort of plus 80, plus 100 sizes. And they could be selling for, between $1,000 and $1,500 per ton. And then you wind all the way down to the smaller sizes, as we talked about, which is ultimately going into the battery. And you can get anywhere between $250 to $600, or maybe a little bit more if you're selling into the niche Western markets. But each and every one of those is obviously a completely different price. There's nothing necessarily that tells you what the prices are. There are a few experts, or so-called experts, who are aware of a lot of different prices, because they have got long-standing relationships with various different buyers and sellers. And so they sort of maintain, I guess, a what's the right word? I was going to say a register, but they certainly maintain a spreadsheet of what the prices and price movements are looking like. And then you can start to work out what average prices for different sizes and different varieties, and in particular for higher and lower values within those, what they're going for. And ultimately, it's a question of negotiating the best prices that you can. And yeah, look, it's certainly at the in the past up to now been buyer's market. So they've put a lot of pressure on the miners and squeezed quite a few of them down considerably. But I think that that dynamic is changing. And I think you're going to start seeing it become more of a seller's market going forward. And that will create a different dynamic of its own. So, oh, well, maybe I'm just hoping that it will become a seller's market, because I'm going to be one of them.
But so, how should investors who don't have this inside track approach the problem of working out when the graphite price is moving or when it might move? Or perhaps to put it another way, suppose there's a squeeze on supply and the graphite price does move. How is anybody going to know about it other than when people like you start talking about it? Is there any other way in to the sort of world of graphite
Yeah,
pricing?
that's a really good point. I mean, I don't know how they would know about it, because it's not, every day I turn on my radio when I'm driving and somebody tells me what the gold price is today, and sometimes what the iron ore price is, and this and that. So you don't have anybody sort of telling you what the graphite price is for, plus 80 large flake. So it's difficult. There are, as I say, a few sort of industry experts who publish on a quarterly basis what's happening in the prices. And I think once you're sort of in this world, you become a little bit closer to it and a little bit more aware of what's changing in terms of the dynamics. But at the end of the day, look, we haven't really got that deep into it, to be honest, because we haven't yet started producing. So I don't really know how it moves once you're in production and obviously on a quarter by quarter, year by year change, because it does move. There's no question it's gone up and gone down over the last years. But you have to keep your nose close to the ground, ear close to the ground, whatever that saying is. And you have to be aware of what the price is doing, what the demand supply fundamentals are going in. And I think it's very important to do that because, if we are anticipating there's going to be a squeeze and there could well be an excess of demand over supply, that could start to change the prices quite a lot. And, make no mistake, the end users are not going to come and say, we'd like to offer you twice as much today. The dynamic that changes that is if they have more demand and they can't get hold of supply and they're all coming and clamoring at your door, well, then you probably realize that it's time to start hiking up your prices because you've got something that they will want. That's just the laws of demand and supply at the end of the day, isn't it? With like selling anything down at the market, tomatoes at the market.
Yeah. So you're based over there in Australia. That's where your office is. And I believe there was a graphite boom in Australia some years ago, where it just became all the rage to have a graphite company. And then that sort of faded a little bit. Are there any sort of noticeable differentials now between how the Aussie market treats graphite companies and the UK market treats graphite companies? And any sort of meaningful comment to be made about the investor base and their attitudes towards graphite in the different
Look, I
jurisdictions?
think the Australian market probably has a little bit more experience because the likes of Syrah Resources and some of the earlier graphite producers or graphite companies moved a little bit quicker. There's certainly a few more of them here on the ASX than there are, for example, in London. So in a sort of general sense, I'd say the Australian market does understand it a little bit better. But having said that, the market itself is Mr. Man in the street, and he doesn't really understand most of what I've just spoken to you about over the last half an hour. So the reality is, every single investor into a mining company, junior or not, is trying to find what they consider to be the next mineral or metal that's going to be in significant demand. They're all sort of listening to the taxi driver, and he's telling them what he thinks, and everybody's sort of making their 2 cents worth as a judgment call, the old counter-cyclical one. And then they're all trying to say, okay, if graphite, for example, is considered to be the next one of the next metals that's going to take off, which company should in that space should I be looking at? And to me, it's not necessarily so much about where it's listed. It's really more about where the project is located, and what it looks like as a project. And there are other things that matter beyond that in terms of the strategy and in terms of the relationships to help get it into production and deliver on that strategy. But fundamentally, and it's probably no different. I mean, I've done gold, I've done base metals, I've done coal. At the end of the day, the project is the project. And if you've got a ripper of a project, it really helps. If you've got a poor project, you can be the best spruiker in the world. And I've known some pretty good ones. But generally, you get found out after a while because at the end of the day, you're selling a product that's inferior. So, yeah, if investors are sort of looking, I wouldn't necessarily be saying, oh, I've got to go to the ASX to look for a graphite company versus London. I mean, it's not that. It's more about what does the project look like? Is it in a safe location to build a long-term project? That's extremely important because there are a number of locations that I wouldn't touch with a barge pole. But beyond that, is it a project that's ultimately got the basic fundamentals that, may well help it to achieve success? And for me, that's down to low capital cost to start it up, low operating cost to try and ensure a margin, and a high purity of end product to actually get sales, particularly, when the market is tough. But also, as you start to build and expand, you want to make sure that you can actually sell, higher volumes of end product. So, Yeah, those fundamentals matter, but yeah, as I say, I think they probably matter in most things at the end of the day as well. So, it's not a whole lot different to other mining projects, but I think where it's slightly different is that there's a lack of transparency as to how you're going to take it all the way through to the end user and what you're going to achieve for that. And so it probably requires a little bit more research into that company and what it looks like in terms of its strategy and in terms of its product and in terms of the mining operation.
So you mentioned something in passing just now, which I was going to ask earlier, but we moved on to different subjects. So should we consider graphite a metal in this
Well,
context?
technically, it's not a metal. Technically, it's
Yeah.
a mineral. I sometimes call it a metal because people just don't necessarily understand if you call it a mineral.
Yeah.
But it is technically not a metal. It is a mineral.
But it seems like it seems like calling it a metal actually does make some sense in the sort of context in which we are sort of operating at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, to me, I just don't care. I mean, whether you
Yeah.
call it a mineral, whether you call it a metal, I mean, to the end punter out there in the street, it just doesn't make an iota of difference to them, does it?
I don't know. I mean, when you have your graphite tennis racket, which you talked about at the beginning, it sort of feels metallic in a way, doesn't it?
Or your graphite shaft on your golf club. I mean, it
Yeah.
does, for sure,
Yeah.
but that's a lot of the products that they're blending with it when they make it. It's
Right,
not
right.
just solely graphite. They'll obviously have different strengthening alloys that they put in there with it to make sure it's not too brittle and snaps straight away.
Yeah. And while we're on the consumer aspect of it, I mean, people obviously know graphite from their pencils. Is that actually a major source
It
of
is
demand?
actually. I mean, there's still a big worldwide demand for lead pencils, and graphite is definitely used for that. So yeah, and you know, some of the things which don't necessarily get mentioned, I guess, as often is graphite is actually used in almost every battery. So our lead acid batteries that we drive our ICE cars at the moment have a decent component of graphite. The alkaline batteries that are used to, you know, for your remote control, they have graphite within them as well. Cell phones have graphite. Plenty of things that you don't necessarily understand. Of course, they're not huge, big volumes in some of those things like cell phones, but yeah, the pencils, definitely require graphite, and it's I can't tell you off top of my head how many tons per annum is used in that, but it's actually quite a sizable portion of that traditional market.
So, do you imagine that some of the graphite you might end up producing will end up in people's pencils then?
Could do. It could do because you know, we could easily be selling it to a middleman player or middle OEM that ends up with their own supply chain or their own customers that they're supplying into. And some of them may have end uses that we're not aware of. You know, as I've said a few times, we're not a completely integrated end-to-end miner who's selling the end product. We've got a bunch of different processing people in the middle. We have a slightly different strategy in Blenco that we're trying to take one step further down that line and get an SPG produced in country, which we think will help commercialize and help with the success for our overall modeling. But most miners, almost all of them, are just content to make a concentrate and sell that, and they wouldn't have a clue where their product is ending up. They wouldn't even want to know, I guess. They're just selling it to a middleman. Thank you very much. Off you go.
So you talked earlier about how the smaller flakes are lower margin, but they are used in EV batteries, and I assume that's one reason why you guys at Blenco have tied up this deal with the European bus company. I can't remember its name, Mike, but you'll
Safe
tell.
Loop is the name of the initiative.
Yes, Safe Loop.
Yeah,
That's right.
it's not a European bus company. It's actually the EU trying to deliver a standardized EV bus across the continent using a Generation 3 lithium-ion battery.
Yeah, sorry, I garbled
No, 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 that's fair enough.
the intro there. So Safe Loop. So, but to sort of follow on from the points you were making earlier, that the idea is that because this part of your product is lower margin, tying in customers like SafeLoop makes sense as to do that as early as you can, and that's what you have done.
Yeah, I mean, to try and put it into sort of money terms, we are one of the lower cost operators out there, and I think we're going to be sort of close to $400 per ton to deliver an end product as a concentrate. But there are people out there in the market, particularly in the higher cost places like Australia and Canada, that would be producing the same ton of graphite for probably double that, 800, maybe even close to $1,000 per ton in some cases, where they have to dig a bit deeper, etc. And that part of it, or that half of your end product that you're selling as a small flake concentrate, if you're selling it into the Asian markets today, into China, you'll be getting about, well, if it's a good product, you'll be getting about $550 per ton. If it's a not a very good product, you'll be getting about $350 per ton. So you can appreciate that you're underwater, or it's at best break even on 50% of your end product. And that doesn't make for a good commercial model. And you don't have to be a wizard to realize that if you're not making money on half of what you're selling, you better be making an awful lot of money on the other half, or you're literally underwater. So our and I think the answer that most of I can see anyway, and maybe I'm being a bit unfair, but the what I see a lot of my peers doing is just sitting back and holding their breath and hoping like mad that this demand supply imbalance that's forecast will drive up the prices of that small flake concentrate. So instead of being $500 per ton, it might actually get to $1,000 per ton, and suddenly they are making a little bit of money, and it all makes a bit more sense. But I find that a very sort of negative strategy, because when I first started this 5 years ago, I was told the same thing, and I said, "When they said in 5 years' time it'll be $1,000 per ton." Well, here we are 5 years later, and it's not. And who's to say that in 5 years' time it will be there? And look, I'm a believer. I do think there's going to be a shortage, and I do think that those prices will therefore rise. But I don't know when, and I don't know how much, and I don't want to sort of leave that to chance. So our view is go and find different ways in which you can enhance or the value adding in that half of your end product that doesn't make you the big money. And in simple terms, downstream beneficiating to get to that 99.95 SPG, that can help a lot, because that product sells for about 2,500. And if you're involved in that, you're going to get more profit. Secondly, micronization, as I said, if you grind it down to smaller micron sizes and sell it into niche markets, you can get significantly higher prices, but they're very small markets. So it's not going to make a massive difference, but it will make some. And then, what we really are learning is that if you get into some of the Western markets, they typically pay a lot better than the Chinese market, but they are smaller. So you've got to try and find your way into them. And how do you do that? Well, they're people that have been doing it for a long time, so they've got long-standing relationships, and good luck to them. Or you do it through product quality, because you've suddenly got people looking at what you've got and they like it. For us, the product quality is what got us into that SafeLoop initiative, through one of the technical specialists over in the USA that is working on this project. And because they recognized that our purified product was very, very pure, and they wanted to have the best product into these generation three batteries, we were invited to give samples, and obviously once they're proven, to become the exclusive supplier into SafeLoop. And what the European Union is trying to do is to ensure that if buses across the continent become electric, you don't end up having a completely different bus with a completely different battery in each country, because it just does not make sense. And it certainly makes a lot of logical sense to standardize it. And in doing that standardization, produce a high quality battery for the obvious reasons. And this particular generation three battery is focusing on safety, because you may have heard that sometimes these lithium ion batteries do get hot. The energy density for lithium is severe, and as such, it sometimes gets overheated and can catch fire. But they're focusing very much on that aspect, and they're also focusing on recyclability, because at the end of the day, there's a big question mark over what happens when these batteries run out of their shelf life, and we've got to fill up landfill with them. So, safety, recyclable, or sustainability, as they call it, and obviously performance. And we think that that's a really, really good project to be part of. It's a couple of years in the development phase, which the EU are funding. And ultimately, if it goes through into production, which I suspect it will, because I don't see any reason why it won't, then it creates a big opportunity for us to sell a huge amount of the small flake concentrate for the batteries into a Western offtake partner at decent prices. And that changes that dynamic I was talking about earlier in terms of the profitability per ton, and obviously allows us to have a channel by which we can sell a significant volume at a higher price. Because at the moment, selling into the Western markets, they're just smaller volumes, and you just can't, you can produce 5,000 tons and sell all of it into the Western markets. But if you're to try and get up to commercial scale, say 50 or 100,000 tons, which is where you want to be to make good money in your mine and get your operating costs down, then you can't be selling those volumes into the European and Western markets today. But Safeloop may change that for us, and that's what makes it so important for us, is that it creates a huge opportunity as a Western offtake partner going forward. And that's a dynamic that not a lot of other graphite companies have right now.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about standardization of batteries, because that seems to be key to Safeloop. And now I'm going to approach this from one direction, and you'll tell me if I've got it wrong, Mike. But I'm aware that if you bring your Tesla from North America over to Europe and try and charge it, that won't work. Now, are we talking about deliberately avoiding the same kind of problem in the European bus network by making sure that a German spec battery is the same spec as a Portuguese one, as the same as an Italian one, and that they all match up in a way
Look,
that
I think the EU would ideally like it to be like that.
yeah.
I'm not close enough to the powers that be making these decisions. I mean, this is all part of the European Union's Project Horizon, which is a $100 billion project at top level EU to try and energy transition. And Safeloop is just one small part of it.
Yeah.
Look, I cannot say whether the powers that be within Germany and France and Italy and all these places are going to achieve the kind of standardization that the EU would like. In practice, these things are never quite as standardized as they seem in theory. But you can appreciate what I've said makes a lot of sense. And if they
Yeah.
can standardize, by the way, when you talk about bringing things over, it's really, I mean, you can actually charge a battery. I've got a lithium-ion battery, for example, in my golf buggy, and I take it out every night and I bring it home and I plug it in when I play golf to recharge it for the next time I go. But if I went over to from Australia to the UK, I could charge it. It's not unchargeable just because I'm in the UK. Obviously, I'm going to need a different socket to get it into the wall, because the world somehow has not realized that it would be pretty nice if they actually allowed us to all put the same plug into the wall wherever you are. That just seems a step too far. But these things can move around and you can still recharge. And I think that the standardization of the battery is really to get one battery that's produced in one way that has the same valuable properties. And obviously it can then be mass produced at a better price. And you can, you're dealing with one or two suppliers. You're not dealing with 50 who are all going in different directions. That's what it's all about, really.
So, do we know at this point who will make the bus batteries that Safeloop is talking about?
Yeah, the Gigafactory is a company in Turkey called Aspilsan. You can go and Google them if you want. They are preferred manufacturer of the battery, but somebody else will be producing the anode that goes into that battery. So, as I say, everybody's got their little piece of the pie. You kind of make it, you move it on to the next. They sort of add their 2 cents worth and pass it along, and ultimately it gets to the Gigafactory, who will make the battery itself, and then they'll pass that on, which goes into the rolling stock manufacturer, who puts it into the bus. And in theory, it's a great concept because you've got experts in all of these different fields who are working together to ultimately produce something of great value. We're going to be at a conference or at a meeting of Safeloop in a couple of months, meeting up with all these various different team members and parties, and it'll be very interesting to sort of get their views on it all as to what the size and scale of this looks like. Because look, some of the numbers we've been given in terms of our requirement for natural flake graphite are absolutely huge. excuse me, frightening in a good way, because it means I can scale up my production to something that really makes a lot of sense. But it's clearly a big project that the EU really want to put a lot of a lot of thrust behind in order to make sure that they create, if you're moving across from a petrol or diesel buses standard to an electric, that they do it in a way that's makes a lot of sense going forward.
So let's do a little flow sheet then, a verbal flow sheet. We take your small flake graphite from in the ground where it is in Uganda. What stages will it go through before it ends up in the Turkish gigafactory?
Well, as I said before, we mine it, we'll take it to a concentrate. In this particular instance, for Safeloop, we'd probably be selling it as a concentrate. So it's a small flake concentrate sold. Now, at this point, we don't know exactly who's going to be our buyer, because it'll be one of several parties within the Safeloop team. But within that team, there's going to be a preferred party that will manufacture the anodes. And so they will either themselves or have another party underneath them that will be purifying the graphite and then putting it into the anode. Once they've created this anode, they will then sell it into the battery manufacturer, the gigafactory, who will put it together with the cathode, and ultimately it becomes the end product as a lithium-ion battery. So different parties doing their little bit along the way. And as I said, I don't know exactly the names of who's going to be buying for us. That's one of the things I've got to work out when we're all together, because there are various different options as to whether parties that have got the technology are actually going to be doing the manufacturing, or whether they're going to subset that out to other people to do it for them.
And do you guys sell FOB, as they say in the mining sector, or how does it work from that perspective?
We will again. It could be different, because we're looking to sell SPG as well, but yeah, we would be looking to sell FOB.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about the Oran Cross project then before we close, Mike. Just tell us sort of some of the bullet point highlights of why it's a project that looks worth developing to you guys.
Well, let's go back and sort of dissect all the key points that we've talked about over the last 30, 40 minutes. Is first of all, I said you want to make sure that you're in a project that's in a safe location. Now, for me, you can probably tell with my accent, I come from Africa. I was born and bred in Zimbabwe in Southern Africa, and I actually spent 5 years living in Kenya in East Africa. So I know the area pretty well. And there's only a handful of countries in Africa that I would bother going and putting a long-term mining project into play, because the rest of them just carry too much risk. And we're like moths to a flame, us mining types, because we get all excited by somebody doing some drilling, some early stage exploration. You suddenly find there's 10 grams per ton of gold, or even better, or 5% copper, and you suddenly, waking up with cold shivers. You're so excited, and then you suddenly realize it's in a location that's either completely inaccessible, or it's got risk in various different other ways, including war, which just make it untenable. Because at the end of the day, you raise a lot of money, you put a lot of time and effort, and it can get taken away from you. So safety of location is paramount. And one of the key aspects when we first did due diligence on Oran Cross was ha having a really good look at Uganda. And for us, a former British protectorate, and don't underestimate the fact that they speak English, because that's very important. Some of these places that speak Portuguese or something, it becomes very tricky. It's a very benign place in terms of what goes on there. And I'm not saying that in a negative way. I'm saying that positively. I think the East Africans work very hard. That particular country is very anxious, from the very top man himself right through to various people on the ground, to try and lift itself up and show it as being a much bigger and better resource and mining company country than it is, because it's probably sat under the radar for a long time, and definitely in comparison with some of its neighbors. So we like Uganda a lot. It's got some key focal points and characteristics which make it stand out, and one of those is that it's got an awful lot of water. The Nile River starts at Lake Victoria and then runs through various lakes in Uganda, and it's a very powerful current of water. So they've put some hydroelectric stations, power stations there, and there's abundant, cheap energy through that national grid, and it's very stable. So that's a huge advantage. One of the biggest costs in any mining operation, and particularly in a beneficiation plant, is power. And in this world where sustainability is important, having it as hydropower is important too. So Uganda, big tick for us. And probably the only negative we found about Uganda is that it's a landlocked country. It's quite far away from getting it to a port. But if we were mining and selling iron ore, coal, or something where you're literally exporting tens, if not hundreds of millions of tons a year, that would be a problem because it would cost too much money. But in the case of graphite, we're only talking about moving anywhere between 20 to 50, maybe 100,000 tons, and so it's not a big number. And we can get it to the port quite cost effectively as well. So the country is one aspect. Then we move on to the project. And I mentioned this before. You've got to have the trifecta, the Holy Grail, as I've been known to call it: low operating cost, low capital cost, high purity of end product. We've got all three. And I can't say enough how much that matters. Because our job as a management team is to try and get the best out of your project. But it's like having the 14th best horse in the Epsom Derby, and you're whipping this thing to death as you come around the last bend, and it's giving its all, but it's never going to make it past the finishing post first because it just doesn't have enough to make it. If you've got a project that doesn't have full component of my trifecta, you've got a world of problems. And I don't want to specify particular pairs because I don't think that's the right forum to do it. But some of them I can see have got very high capital costs. And it's taken them years and years and years to try and assemble together debt and equity. And by the time they've done it all, it's gone up by another 20% through inflation. And then they go and grab hold of that. And once they're actually in production and trying to service that debt or repay it, they're going to have other problems to deal with. And then the other one is obviously the operating costs. At the end of the day, you're in a high cost jurisdiction. I live in one of them here in Australia. It's ridiculously difficult to mine anything cost effectively here today. And ultimately, in graphite, that matters for the reasons we discussed earlier in terms of half of your end product selling for a lot less, particularly if you're only selling a concentrate. So low operating costs, low capital costs, and then purity of end products. I mean, we've done a lot of traveling around China, Korea, and Japan in the last couple of years now. And, you quickly realize that they talk about some people's product as just being pretty low quality, pretty poor, and they're never going to get good prices for it. So ultimately, those three things mattered for us. We've got them all, and that makes a big difference. And then, without going into this too long and too involved, it's about the strategy, because we've now got a strategy that takes us away from just selling that 50% of small flake as a concentrate. We're going to either be selling it into something like a safe loop, or we're going to be further processing it into the SPG to make better returns. And then finally, last but certainly not least, it's the relationships. And at the end of the day, key relationships like the party that's going to come and help build and operate an SPG facility with us, very experienced SPG producer, that matters. And there are only a handful of them in the world, so you can't take your pick from too many. And we've obviously got one of them. And people like the Development Finance Corporation, who've given us a $5 million grant and ultimately looking to fund 50% of the project going forward into production. These kind of relationships are absolutely huge, and ultimately they matter. So for me, it's the project, looking at those key trifecta fundamentals. It's looking at the strategy. What can you do to raise the value of what you've got? And then the relationship, in order to help make it happen. And finally, of course, it's the management team. Have you got the experience? Have you got the ability, to not just deliver the standard bog standard, it's to deliver outside the box and make sure it works. And look, time will tell on that one because we haven't got to production yet, but we've certainly come a long way in 5 years. Most of our peers have been rattling around in the space for 10 to 15 years, and I think we've caught them all up. So, our ambition is to get this project into production in an early stage next year, and thereafter to expand it and obviously prove it can be one of the best and most successful graphite projects in the world.
So production next year, that's great to hear. What can you say about the economic studies that you've done or you are doing in terms of the types of numbers that investors can expect?
Yeah, we did a PFS a couple of years ago, which showcased a very profitable, low cost, low capital cost, low operating cost, profitable, and that was great. But we were only going to sell a concentrate, both as large and small flake within that. And we had taken numbers that are sort of bandied around by the so-called experts, and shoved those into our PFS, just like everybody else does. But when we were running around China doing our bulk sample pre-qualification process, getting all those samples through to the end users, we realized that the prices that you're certainly going to get in China, where most of the bigger quantities are sold, are just not as high as people were saying. So we realized that you can try and fool yourself. And because it's not really, really known, as you say, the market doesn't care about it like it does in terms of the gold price or iron ore or something else, the market isn't aware. So it's very easy for companies to pull the wool over people's eyes and say, oh, we're going to be hugely profitable because we're going to be selling at a weighted average basket price of $2,000 per ton. And it's quite difficult for the man in the street to say, hold on, that's just not true. But I'm not a fond fan of pulling the wool over my own eyes, because I can tell you it can lead you to run into a brick wall at 100 miles an hour. So we realized that we needed to understand this in what I consider to be a realistic selling price environment. And it said to me loud and clear, you've got to go and find different ways to sell your product that make sure that you're going to get more value. And so we've taken a bit longer with this DFS than I expected for two reasons. Firstly, we entered into this long-term, I guess, pre-qualification process of digging the stuff out of the ground in bulk, getting it over to China, putting through facilities, ultimately getting product purified, and then sending all this off to the end users and them testing it. That takes a long time. I mean, we did a 600-ton bulk sample test. We started that in January last year, and it's literally only completed in the final months of last year. So these things, and they're pretty expensive to do all of that as well. So it's taken a bit longer for the DFS. That's taken a bit more time. And ultimately, getting through to end users and getting contracts, offtake contracts, is a key part of the DFS. So you can't just nudge it to one side and say, we'll have a DFS without any offtake contracts. It's not going to work. But we're getting there. I mean, we're moving pretty quickly. We've done that pre-qualification in probably half the time many other companies have done it. And I think we've done it well. I think we've done it to the point we've got some excellent offtake opportunities in front of us. And so I've always got to try and find the balance between the market wanting me to move at warp speed, because they've got a very impatient attitude towards mining companies that don't get into production yesterday, and also doing it properly, because at the end of the day, whoever comes and funds us, needs to see that we're going to deliver and be successful. So, and always at the end of that, the latter, which is doing it properly, will override the need to do it super fast. Even though I try to move as quickly as I can every single day, generally it's third parties that let you down. We, whenever something's in our hands, it gets done very fast. We can control that. But with all that said, we're trying to complete a DFS by the middle of this year. And then that stage one production can happen very quickly, because it's a very small plant that we're going to put up. And hopefully by the first quarter of next year, that will be up and operating. And that really showcases that we've moved very quickly. I think it'll be 6 years. And I was speaking to a fund manager the other day who mentioned that the typical mine takes between 10 and 15 years to start up and bring to production. So if we did it in six, okay, I'll say fair is fair. We did have some drilling and some exploration work done before we took over the project, but most of the work we've had to do ourselves, and that would be a pretty good result. We're not there yet. We've still got a few hurdles to jump across, including funding that first stage. But we are talking to various parties at the moment, and there's a lot of interest, so I think we'll get there.
I think the market will really enjoy it if you get into production next year, Mike, and it'll be nice to
Yeah.
have some good news from the mining industry.
Yeah, I know. And don't forget, the Ugandan government want to see it into production, because it's the first battery metals project from their country. They suddenly start showcasing that they've got mines starting. Everybody wants to see it in production. The people like the DFC who are backing us, for them, it's all about critical mineral supply chain, energy transition, things like that. They want to see it up. We obviously want to see it up. And obviously the end users want to see it up, because there's going to be a shortage. So everybody's kind of working in the same way. Look, the biggest challenge is number one, there are things that just take time, like I've said, the pre-qualification. And the other one is that is funding. You know, the market always wants to fund you for production. They don't want to fund you for your pre-production work, i.e. your feasibility studies, etc. That's just the nature of it. I mean, the market wants to eat the cake. They don't want to bake it. And you know, our big challenge as juniors, and I imagine that all my peers in the same boat, is just finding that early stage money that gets you through to the point of getting into production. Thereafter, it's a little bit easier because everybody can see a return. And you know, obviously they want to back something that can give them money back. So yeah, it's there's always challenges, make no mistake. We've got many of them in front of us right now, but I've got a good team. We've got a great project, very differentiated and unique. And we know that we're onto a winning ticket. We've got the horse that's right up there at the front as they've come around the bend, and I don't have to whip it. It's getting there on its own on its own four legs.
Yeah, well, Mike, I'm glad to hear it. It's been great talking to you. Thanks for taking the time to tell us all about graphite and Blanco, and we'll keep in touch and we'll be watching with interest as you guys make further progress.
It's a pleasure, and it's been great talking to you. Thanks very much for having me.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.